Hey everyone, welcome to a new episode of Tech Can't Save Us podcast, brought to you by Literal Humans. As always, I'm one of your co-hosts, Paul David, co-founder and CEO of Literal Humans, and I'll let my co-host introduce himself again.
Hey guys, William Gatsby-Pete here, the other co-founder of Literal Humans. I'm very excited for another fascinating pod.
We are both sweating it out here in very, very hot London, but we are super excited to have Daniel Newman, who's the president and co-founder of MapLight. Daniel, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you. Pleasure to be here with both of you.
Dan, we go way back a bit. I was on the board of MapLight for a while, and a big, obviously because of that, and even before that, big fan of what you all do. Would love you just give our audience a quick overview of MapLight, what you do there, and how important it is to democracy.
Thank you. Yeah, MapLight is a nonprofit organization that uses technology to improve democracy. So there's billions of dollars in investment into how to get people to click on online ads and buy more and have surveillance by corporations and government. But there's really not enough investment in the civic applications of technology. How do we actually use it to come together? How do we use it to hold government accountable? And that's the area where MapLight focuses. I started the organization 17 years ago after running a couple technology companies. And our core focus is on money and politics, voting rights, accountability for government.
That's great. Thanks, Daniel. And as we typically do on Tech Can't Save Us, we like to jump right into the headlines at the beginning. So we'll definitely jump back to, you know, hearing a lot more about MapLight and all the good work that you're doing. But yeah, first things first, we shared a couple articles with you. We tailored the articles to the work that you do. And we know that our audience is particularly interested in hearing your perspective on these issues. So in terms of the first piece that we shared, it was about domestic spying and how that tool has been used to undermine some of the racial justice protests that we've seen in the past years. We know that MapLight has taken a strong stance, against digital deception. But we're curious to hear your take on, you know, when this misuse of digital tools comes from state actors themselves. What's your take on that?
Well, unfortunately, the surveillance of lawful protest and communications activities dates back like early in the Republic. And you have, some major examples from the civil rights movements in like the 1950s and the 1960s is the FBI infiltrating lawful protest. And when I say lawful protest, this is like important social movements that have increased freedom for all Americans and increased justice. So you have this long history in America and other countries of using surveillance for really nefarious anti-democratic purposes. And so this article about this is really the latest iteration, tools to scrape social media, setting up the government agents, setting up fake accounts to infiltrate. This continues to have a corrosive effect on the Black Lives Matter movement and other current social movements just being under surveillance. So this is something that it is new in the technology that's being used, but it's very old in terms of the injustice of it and the problematic effects for the country.
Yeah, we did a podcast with Erica Shizu Banks where she was talking about how like activists nowadays almost have to be, you know, social media influencers in terms of knowing what platforms they can use and the tech stack. You know, they have to be aware of the latest product with the best encryption just to organize for peaceful protests, which is just, you know, such a terrifying place to be, where a 17-year-old activist that just wants less police brutality in their hometown has to download Telegram so that she doesn't worry about the FBI listening in on the conversations. It's so Orwellian.
It is, and there's really, I think, a continuum from democracy and freedom and justice on one hand to authoritarian control of people on the other. And we see this, right, like again, China has made, it just continues to make extensive use of facial recognition, all sorts of invasive spying technology, social scores to sort of ensure compliance with authoritarian goals. And here in the country, of course, it's every day in the headlines, there's the forces of authoritarianism are pushing to break up American democracy, with Trump just the largest symbol of that, but really also a symptom as well as a cause. And so I look at these use of the technology of the United States, it's part of this continuum, and it's so important to fight back and make these things not legal and hold the government offices account that use them, because it's every little step matters. And the work that MapLight does we focus on money in politics, exposing digital deception, trying to get more transparent where the sources of disinformation are. So that's like one piece of a much bigger puzzle. And what Black Lives Matter and other activist groups are doing, pushing back on authoritarianism, fighting for racial justice, that's another piece. And so one of the challenging characteristics of improving the country is it takes so many small steps. And any of us working on it, it's easy to think, well, I'm just making a small difference. But really, in the aggregate, all these things matter. And what you folks are talking about like the problems with the surveillance spying, like it's a powerful, important tool in the hands of government that really has nefarious purposes. And so pushing back on that is also a really important piece.
Yeah, and you open up a perfect segue into the second piece that we share with you from Freedom House about the transnational nature of this and how this is happening to sort of human rights activists and journalists, across borders. So just be curious to hear your perspective on any efforts that you've seen. Are there any precedents in international law or any tools that you've seen sort of span borders that you think, folks can use to kind of defend against this particular form of transnational, digital deception?
Yeah, well, part of it is of the tools that are being used and like the, apps that are encrypted and such. And, Google some years ago came out with like a simplified version of Google Docs that's highly encrypted that you need a little key to use. And I think it was in response to some of these like highly, like most of us are reading some of the state or reading our email is not going to blow up our careers. But for some people, it not only blows up their careers, but can put them in jail. And so it's good that there's been some responsiveness to tools like that. I'm also looking at like, what is the EU doing on like, data privacy and rules about monopolies. And, there needs to be like transnational effort by governments to crack down on some of these things. I mean, in a different forum about corporate taxation, you have governments across the world getting together and say, we're going to have a minimum worldwide tax rate, right? That's not a technology issue, but it's a government cooperation issue. And these are some of the things that need to happen with in the U.S. Unfortunately, the regulators are much more captured by industry than in the EU. But it's great that they're such a less influence in the U.S. and are able to lead as are other countries as well.
Yeah, I do think there is a sort of two pieces of it. And I think, and we've already seen this, individuals need to become more aware of like some of the stuff that is doable with data and actually not just doable but definitely happening with their data. And then more at the larger scale, the long-term solution, governments need to do a better job of policing it. And it always seems like the regulation comes in after something terrible's happened. Facebook have only just started clamping down seriously on, and it's only after 5 years of negative headlines about, election interfering, et cetera, et cetera. And one of the truly scary things about, the Russian interference that, depending on your perspective and who you read, quite feasibly put Trump in the White House is not that, a foreign government could do it. It's that 5 years ago with those tools, if you had given me as a digital marketer the customer list they had and their budget, I could have done it. Like, you think it's this master plan by the Kremlin. Any digital marketing manager with that data and that budget could have done it. So, the oversight and policing of these tools has been terrible and just needs to improve, across the board to stop this stuff because it is so dangerous and widespread, and just some of it's just so dumb. It's just like it's leaving a child with a bunch of matches and petrol and being like, oh, I can't believe the house is on fire. It's like, obviously, what did you think was going to happen?
Well, this gets to really why fixing our broken democracy is at the heart of so many problems. Like, why is it that Facebook can get away with ignoring basic safeguards on information and democracy? There's certainly plenty of people in the country that want to see Facebook change and plenty of people in the government, including elected officials as well. But because they're such a large lobbyist, and that's true for Facebook and Google and every other tech company, every corporate industry in general, it just blocks action in the public interest. And, climate is another example of this. We saw this great climate victory. Hopefully will be signed this week after the House passes it. In the U.S., but this is after literally 50 years, like five decades of the U.S. government being, knowing that climate change is a problem and corporate influence from fossil fuel industries really preventing that. And so, Will, your example is right. What do you expect to happen if you set things up this way? We really need to change the underlying accountability systems as part of what we need to change all of these issues.
Something that will never not just be just such a it's a piece of information that I've learned and has always just made me sad ever since, is the most amount of research ever done into climate change initially was done by ExxonMobil. They predicted everything that's happened over the last 45 years in the 70s and went, fuck it, we don't care. We're going to carry on selling oil and we'll deal with these issues later, and we're going to actively deny everything we know is coming down the pike because we are scientists and we invested in the research. And yeah, it's just, it's Bond villain level of like, yeah, we know this is going to screw the planet, we don't care. It's just, yeah. Always makes me sad.
Yeah, so we have the Republican Party being perhaps the only political party in the world that is a climate denier party, and they're also the party that receives the overwhelming amount of fossil fuel contributions.
And yet we still allow them to run the government, one of the most powerful governments in the world. So that's on us. I guess another one of the things I love about MapLight, to kind of take us in a slightly different direction, but take a potentially more positive direction, is you all are, you know, actively building tools to kind of counter this erosion of democracy and to counter digital deception. Would love to hear, you know, a bit more about that and your perspective on this third article of, you know, using AI, for example, to counter disinformation and digital deception. If you could sort of weave your response to that article and then maybe take us into some of the work MapLight's doing to build tools to kind of counter this onslaught. Would love to hear it.
Sure. So with it, you know, AI to fight disinformation, it's just not really going to work that well. You know, disinformation is a challenging problem. One of the characteristics of that is its oppositional nature. So it means that as much as folks on the, you know, the positive side are trying to tamp down on disinformation, there's people who are benefiting from it financially and politically that are always looking to push the envelope. So if there's sort of a tick AI tool, then there's like very smart people that are benefiting from disinformation, then they're going to try and get around it. So that's why, you know, sort of tech has like a modest role to play in this in terms of, but ultimately there are some policy solutions. So one of the questions that comes up, well, what kind of policy solutions are going to tramp down on disinformation? I'll tell you some of the work that MapLight's done just to put out some illustrations, some ideas. And this is from a website we published called voterempowermentplan.com that lists these. So one basic rule is to apply the same transparency rules to online ads that are applied to TV and radio. So if you are spending money on political influence, like your campaign or an independent expenditure to promote a candidate, you have to put certain like reporting on like who's paying for the ad, and you have to report it to the government. So you don't have to do that online, which is ridiculous, right? Like a TV ad has to have who it's paid for, but the same TV ad on Facebook doesn't. So that's like an obvious change. We know that when people know the sources of the information, that they are appropriate more skeptical than if there are no sources and it just looks like something, quote, organic. Now, another example is to require access to social media data for researchers and journalists and the public. So right now, only Facebook has access to Facebook's data. That data could tell us policymakers enormous amounts about not just the problems Facebook is causing, but what specific policy solutions would fix it, yet they don't give that access. So those are two of about a dozen recommendations we have to show that disinformation, there are specific things that can be done to clamp down on the frequency and severity and spread of this disinformation.
I do think as well, like AI can have a role to combat it, but only if it's adopted by the platforms where it's spread. Like, you know, and this is where the really at the heart of the problem. You know, Facebook used to run a page that showed you the top 10 trending stories on Facebook that day, and they were always the most mad, you know, Alex Jones conspiracy, you know, the Democrats are demon worshiper kind of stuff that went trending. And unsurprisingly, Facebook took it down because they were like, oh, maybe we shouldn't show people that the stuff that trends every day is conspiracy theory content. And, you know, similarly, after Biden beat Trump in the election, for, you know, a couple of weeks, they turned on a filter that prioritized fact-based content that was far more peer-reviewed, and everyone's Facebook feed got less spicy and less angry. Like I think Facebook absolutely have the keys to the solution to the problems that beset their platform, and they decide every day not to use them. And I do think that more pressure from their users is potentially the only thing that might one day twist their arm into using it as a solution. But like, Facebook can solve Facebook's problems. They choose not to, and they lie about it. And everyone says, oh, well, you know, Facebook's too you know, complicated. But they did it with the vaccine, and they did it after the Trump-Biden election. They turned on a filter that that took away misinformation. Anyone who was denying any of these things got their post taken down in the same way that if you post any form of sexual content on Instagram, they have the solution to these problems and they choose not to do them so they can claim that they're not biased. Fingers crossed that maybe if enough public pressure grows that they might get their arm twisted into, you know, deploying them as a full-time solution, but you know, I'm not holding my breath.
Well, transparency can be very powerful. It's certainly not the only thing that needs to happen, but it's a necessary condition to have that accountability. Like you gave the example, Will, of those top 10 lists that actually put a lot of pressure on Facebook. So I'll give you an example from MapLight's work. Some years ago, the California legislature was trying to pass a bill that if you lost your phone, you could report it to the phone carriers and they would brick your phone. They would make it permanently inoperable. And this is a really important safety issue, actually, because if someone is going to mug you, threaten you, steal your phone, and they know that they can resell it, then, you know, they'll do that. But if they know that the phone is going to be bricked and permanently disabled, then that reduces theft and violence to people. And so this kill switch bill was it was put through the California legislature and it was defeated. And MapLight found, we put out an analysis right after this happened, MapLight found that the telecom carriers, Verizon, Sprint, and so on, spent $1.4 million over 4 years supporting the campaigns of the California legislature. And the LA Times, largest newspaper in California, wrote an editorial about this. It generated criticism up and down the state of the legislature. And just 1 week later, this kill switch bill was passed. And so now people are safer in California because of exposing the influence of these companies, the telecom companies.
Well, now that we've like dragged ourselves into the doldrums with all these really, I don't know how you keep it up sometimes, Daniel. I mean, it's a lot to deal with, but turning to the brighter side of things, want to share with our audience a bit more about the great work that you've done at MapLight. You know, I think one of the most impressive things that I remember about MapLight is that you built this tool that I think it's 1 in 5 Californians use to get their voter information. And it's just a powerful example of how to use tech for good, to, you know, give people the information and the tools that they need to really burnish and support democracy. So we'd love to just hear about the inspiration behind MapLight and you know, share with our audience some updates about the work you're currently doing.
Sure. So the tool you're referring to, Paul, is called Voters Edge. It's at votersedge.org. If you live in California, when it's time to cast your ballot this November, you go to votersedge.org and you type in your address. You can see everything that's on your ballot, all the way from Congress down to the local school board races. And it gives you meaningful information about these candidates. In some cases, it tells you who's funding them. It tells you the state ballot propositions and who's backing those. This is really a breath of fresh air in this polluted information environment that we're in. So if you, and I say that by what I'm talking about is political advertising. So most of the information that voters get about candidates comes from TV ads, radio, through the mail, and it's always biased, right? It's always on the yes or no side or which one candidate or the other. The news media does, of course, cover races, but they don't have the resources to cover everything. So the votersedge.org is a great way to get that information. And MapLight does that with the League of Women Voters of California in a long-running partnership. We have millions of people that use this site every election. Another example of putting a breath of fresh air, good information on things, is software that we develop to make it governments help with transparency. So the city of Denver has a brand new system that's the best in the country. MapLight built it to make political money transparent. So if you're a candidate for office in Denver, use the MapLight software to file your campaign reports. There's a great website at denver.maplight.com. That is an official Denver government site that you as a member of the public can see where your candidates receive money from. And we expect to increase that kind of transparency software. We already do it for the Secretary of State of California as well, and we expect for other cities and states. Another thing that we have planned is to build a tech-influenced database. So taking all the work that you folks do on your program and tracking Facebook and Google and what they're up to, is to make a website dedicated to the political influence that they're doing. So looking at the lobbying that they're doing, the campaign contributions, how does that correlate with votes? And so MapLight has a long history in this, doing this across all corporations of all types. And we're planning one focused on the tech industry. We're sort of midway through the fundraising for that. And so aiming in the next year to get something up that really is a go-to source for everyone that can unearth this hard-to-find information and make it meaningful and hold these tech companies accountable.
Before we jump into, I know Will's got a question about kind of like the specifics of the technology that you develop, but we'd be curious to hear how the mission and the strategies that you use have evolved over time. Because I feel like the yeah. landscape when you started MapLight compared to now has changed dramatically. So how have you evolved?
Yeah, well, so I come from this trying to pass laws to improve our democracy and get big money out of politics, and with this particular focus on publicly funded elections. So publicly funded elections, or otherwise known as clean elections, it's where people can run for office and they can get matching funds. They collect maybe $10 from, like, say you're running for office in New York City, you collect $10 from someone who wants to support your campaign, and then the city gives you another $60 to run your campaign. And so this radically changes who can run for office and who they pay attention to, because you can raise all the money you need from small donations, and you get it because it's matched by the government. You don't have to focus only on the wealthiest areas. You don't have to focus only on the big special interest. You can be a grassroots candidate and run and win. And this is true in New York City, and it's true in the state of Maine and San Francisco and Connecticut and about 30 other places in the country. In Seattle, they have a version of this called Democracy Vouchers, which is, amazing, successful idea that every citizen, every voter in Seattle gets $100 in coupons, in vouchers, mailed to them each election season, and they can give these to the political candidates of their choice. So if you're running for city council, you don't have to go just to the wealthiest areas. You can go to the areas that, everyone, even the poorest areas, have this $100 that they can give you to run your campaign. And so you can really represent the people as a whole and not special interests. And this has worked great in Washington in changing what the government pays attention to and who can even run and when. And just a few weeks ago, thanks to the efforts of MapLight and our partners, the Oakland City Council voted a democracy measures onto the November ballot. So in just 90 days from now, the citizens of Oakland, California are going to vote over whether to make Oakland the second city in the country after Seattle to have this great democracy vouchers program.
Yeah, there are probably, I always think that the two quickest ways you could improve democracy in pretty much every country in the world is proportional representation and either centrally funded by the government campaigns where all parties get an equal pot, or just a limit of $100 donation per person that just instantly levels the playing field and gets rid of all the special interests that everyone knows just fucks up democracy, but somehow are allowed continually, but in some shape or form, whether it's in the UK or the US or various special interests.
Absolutely, Will, like those are great examples of specific changes that would make a huge difference. And Paul, to your comment on positivity, I wrote this book called Unrig, How to Fix Your Broken Democracy, and it tells about all sorts of really specific things that are already tested and proven in the U.S. to increase democracy, and these would work in many other countries in the world as well. The book is it's unrigbook.com, Unrig, How to Fix Your Broken Democracy, and the amazing thing is it's all told in comics, and it's really easy and fun to understand, and it has great stories of the people that are actually bringing this change about. So it's very much an I can do it kind of book. It's an inspiring book, and it's really the antidote to the headlines that you read now, which, by the nature of the news, it's always pointing out things wrong. The Unrig book points out what's right and what can be done.
Amazing. We'll definitely chuck a link to that in the podcast description. Just kind of, you touched upon a few really awesome examples. I just wondering if you might share some more really cool tech and that you've used with MapLight to kind of build ways that make democracy stronger.
Sure. Yeah. So we're working on a project right now for electronic signatures for ballot measures. So the idea, one of the challenges, there's a lot of democracy, pro-democracy legislation that's very popular, but there's not a lot of funding behind it to get it on the ballot, because often it's really expensive to get things on the ballot in states and cities in the U.S. And so we're building technology that will make that cheaper and easier. Will require states and cities to change the law to allow this, but by making open source software to do this, we're making it possible to to make that kind of direct democracy possible. And I'll give you another example of work that we did around another success, the net neutrality fight. So that was a big, you know, so many actors, so many civil society groups fighting for that some years ago, and it's still really an ongoing battle. MapLight found back during that fight in 2015 that the broadband internet companies, the ones that were really against net neutrality, gave about three times more money to the members of the House, the U.S. House committee that were deciding on that issue, the communications and tech subcommittee. They gave three times more money to that committee than the whole House. So that's an illustration of how the money is concentrated in the people that make the decisions. So that MapLight findings generated 90 news stories across all media, even internationally. 2 million people read those stories. You have these great activist groups like Save the Internet, Demand Progress, sent that out to their members, use it to engage people. And of course, that was a successful net neutrality fight. So that's an example of how we create the data systems of research. We're in touch with what's in the news. We're in touch with what civil society groups need, that we can put it out at the right time to really have a big communications and activist impact.
Yeah, I'd be curious to get your opinion on this, Daniel. Like, it strikes me that, you know, there's this like tension between sort of like access and I guess availability to, you know, things like voting or, you know, just participation in democracy in general on multiple levels, and security and safety and things like that. And I mean, we let people, you know, bank on their phones these days and do all types of, you know, transactions. You know, so like, I'd really be curious to hear your take on how do we sort of like. Well, do we, first of all, push ahead to, you know, a digital democracy era where, you know, voting and participating in your democracy is maybe as easy as banking on your phone or ordering that Deliveroo or you know, whatever delivery service. I've forgotten the ones in the States since I've been over here for so long. But yeah, like, what's your take on that? Like, how do we ensure that it's safe and secure, but also widely available and open?
So I do agree that it needs to be widely available and safe and secure. I think doing it digitally is the wrong way to do it. I think that as many other countries and some, you know, example states have demonstrated, you can have an election that's very open and safe and secure, and you can have it all with paper-based ballots. You know, there's also technologies like ballot marking machines that sort of bridge the gap, that make it easier to people to march their ballot, especially people with disabilities, but then you still have a paper-based system. I mean, really the issue is resources of election. And, you know, elections are very decentralized in the U.S. You have thousands of separate voting jurisdictions, different counties. There needs to be national standards, national funding, things like access. I mean, why do people vote on why is Tuesday election day? Do you folks know why Tuesday? Tuesday is election day because way back in the 1800s, you had to go to the county seat to cast your ballot, and Sunday was church day and Wednesday was market day, and they sort of fit in Tuesday because you had to take your horse and buggy over there, and so Tuesday was the day. So we're still voting on Tuesdays. Like, how inconvenient is that, right? If you have a job, it's really hard to vote on Tuesdays. I mean, you have that. You see this fight now nationally in the States. Like, should we make voting easier by having you be able to vote anytime in the 30 days before? Should you be able to vote by mail? Like, of course you should vote by mail. All these things increase access, they have high security, and you don't need to do them digitally.
Yeah, I do think a lot of the concerns around security in general are manufactured for, you know, nefarious purposes. Like, of course you can do, like, as the States has shown for, you know, 40 years before it became a controversial topic, mail-in ballots can absolutely be fine. And you know, if it works for your overseas troops, why can't it work for your citizens? Like, it, you know, it is a lot of the, like, oh, you know, it's a security issue and people are going to fake votes. It's just bullshit. And you know, it's a totally in bad faith argument done by people who want to make voting as hard as possible because they think that they can, you know, finesse the margins by 2 or 3%, and that'll be enough to keep themselves in power.
Yes. And you mentioned proportional representation, Will. There's some sort of initial versions of that in the U.S. called instant runoff voting, where you can rank your candidates. And that's another way that, like, these things don't turn so much on the margins. Like, right now we have this system that encourages big swings. Like, you know, Trump, as you know, won election over Hillary Clinton by approximately 100,000 votes across three states, like a tiny amount of votes. And then Joe Biden defeated Trump by even fewer votes across the states, even fewer than 100,000 votes. So you have these giant swings in the country based on these tiny little margins. There's mathematical systems that are very simple, like letting you rank candidates that do a better job of just making the, you know, if the country is sort of evenly split, then you get a more evenly split legislature. If one candidate or party is ahead, then that's reflected appropriately. And I'm a big fan of the national popular vote legislation that's making its way through the states. That would, if enough states pass this legislation, then the winner of the presidency would be the person who gets the most votes nationwide, not on this this swing state basis that really gives outsized power to just a relative handful of states and ignores everyone else.
I'd be curious to hear, and especially appreciate your answer as someone who studies, you know, digital democracy, digital deception, anchoring down and like kind of, hey, we should stick with some analog elements to ensure safety and security. So that's, I think, a very important nuanced answer there. Be curious to hear your perspective on like the future of democracy as it relates to tech. And I kind of want to, you know, internationalize, you know, the perspective here a bit and be curious if you've seen anything happen outside the United States in terms of digital democracy and ensuring, you know, fair elections. Maybe supported by tech, anything like that. But just in general, your perspective on what's the future of digital democracy and how is it supported by tech?
I think it's really about organizing and what are the tools that are going to be out there to help people band together. Like Facebook is a tool that that promotes more use of Facebook and more viewing of ads, right? It's not interest in letting people band together. But what are the tools that are out there or that people are creating now that actually let people band together and hold them accountable? I think that kind of innovation is what's needed. There is a new startup I was just reading about this week. I'm actually going to find the name of it. It'll take me a moment or so. But it's centered on organizers. And it's like, let's look at the people that actually know their community members, that just organize things, get things done in their communities. Those people are not well served, right? Because they're not big advertisers. They're not corporations. But those are the things that will actually make a difference. It's called Unified. So that's one I just read about, but there are others. And I think one of the things that can make a big difference is investing in these tools. So for the people who are looking for where to put their donations or their philanthropy or just their efforts, is technology can have an outsized leverage effect. Like MapLight has fewer than 10 people, and we put out work that millions of people use and that tens of millions of people read and see. And that's because technology and information is a high leverage activity. So if you can focus on the core audience of connecting people and putting out information to hold people accountable, then you can do a lot with not too many resources.
Yeah, I do think like the future of potentially tech that sort of relates to democracy is that, you know, this is something we've certainly been seeing in other interviews and just, you know, professionally as a digital marketing agency, is people are getting tired of the platforms that they know have problems with, and you know, there are and it only takes 3 or 4 smart developers to band together to create, you know, don't be wrong, it's not going to have all the bells and whistles of Facebook, but as long as it solves the fundamental problem of Facebook, which is it serves you trash content and makes you an angrier person, you know, users are much more forgiving. We did a podcast interview with the founder of Communia, which is a social network essentially just for women, with a particular focus on kind of the Me Too movement and for women to share stories of, you know, the bullshit they face basically from you know, and get constructive, helpful advice and support. And I do think that those sorts of communities online are going to become much more commonplace as people band together and, like you said, fulfill the original promise of Facebook, which is it's an online community. It's your village, your tribe online. It's going to support you. It's going to help you. And I still think that's, you know, a beautiful vision and one we can take back from, you know, some of the tech giants that have, quite frankly, fucked it up.
Yeah, well said.
Just move ourselves into the lightning round now. So slightly, hopefully funner, less intense questions than the future of our democracy and tech and whether we're going to make it as a society. This one, I'd be super interested to get your answer to, given that you work with so much cool tech. What has been some of the sort of game-changing tech products or the tech stack that you actually personally use? You know, what's a tech product in your life that you just absolutely love?
So Dragon, naturally speaking, speech recognition software. I've been working with that software for more than 20 years. I've actually written books about how to use it. I had had a hand injury early in my career that prevented me from typing for a while. And so speech recognition software, it's now recently purchased by Microsoft. I'm hopeful that they're going to integrate it into the operating system and make it actually work better. But that's definitely an everyday go-to product for me.
I'm so glad you mentioned Dragon, because my dad has been using Dragon since like the mid 90s, and he uses it because he's dyslexic, and so it really helps him with, you know, obviously, you know, communicating and typing and everything like that. But I remember when he first, you know, showed it to me, I was like, this is mind blowing that he would just speak and it would type for him, and just being a kid and being blown away by it. So thank you for resurrecting that memory for me. Next question we like to ask, just around the name of the podcast, Tech Can't Save Us. You kind of gave us a nice entree into this in terms of all the things that like AI can't do, and you know, moving digital for elections can't do for us. So curious, what's one problem that tech can't solve for us, and why?
Yeah, well, so I think it's about community and trust, and I think to really have to make progress in society or as a community, there has to be a face-to-face component. I mean, nowadays that face-to-face could be on Zoom, but there's a way in which for people to work together to a common cause, part of the enjoyment comes from being with other people and understanding them and knowing them and becoming friends with them. That's something that's been part of every way that the U.S. and the world has gotten better. Tech can certainly, you know, Zoom is certainly a facilitator of that in this COVID era, but it's not going to do it by itself.
Favorite question of the entire, this is pretty much the reason I do the podcast, is just ask people this question. But I'm particularly curious to hear your response to this, because you delve into the realms of digital deception each and every day, all day. What's the evilest form of tech that you've seen, the evilest application of tech that you've seen out there?
I think certainly some of the super invasive surveillance that like China and other authoritarian countries do, and that it's a continued fight like to try and get the US not to do that. And second, I think the addictive nature of like social media for kids, like TikTok being a prime example. Like it's just like a giant AI algorithm that no one can beat, that like just gets you to watch more and more. There have been reporting that's come out recently showing how TikTok artificially inflated followers and likes, basically had an algorithm that it looks like people are liking your video, and it looks like these, you know, fake attractive profiles are liking your video. But and high schoolers and everyone else think this is great, and it's just a complete manipulation, sapping the attention of people. And I think a minimum, you know, trying to get ahead of this kind of deception is anything that on your app that is a bot or is not a real person, it should just have to be identified as such. And so there's no ambiguity, because we're going to see this technology keep getting better with avatars and conversation, and just to have that basic transparency about what is not human is one initial way of trying to get ahead of it.
The recent stuff that's come out about the radicalization of young men in particular, and how it's encouraging misogynistic behavior is just absolutely, it's not surprising, but it is really shocking to hear the scale of it and how the algorithms are supporting it, and how, you know, new voices are rising up, and it just makes you think like where are the positive voices that are sort of, you know, intervening, and how are we getting, you know, in front of this and underneath it? And, you know, it's just, I don't know, it's very, very disheartening, but yeah.
Yeah, the amount of times I've heard, you know, someone who I know of and have known for a long time, and, you know, they tell you about sort of something Ben Shapiro said, and you're like, where did you get access to that level of right wing, you know, nonsense? Like, you know, and it's your YouTube algorithm that suggests it to you. I know that you don't believe any of that bullshit. Like, where it can only have come from, you know, a social platform. So yeah, it's a mad, weird little sort of funnel of, you know, you kind of start off with Joe Rogan and then eventually end up at Alex Jones, and there's sort of like five steps of crazy in between, and yeah, it really does radicalize people.
The amount of Jordan Peterson I get in my Instagram feed is insane. And I think they know, they're like, all right, he's a university professor, and he, you know, like they just know that there's like these certain elements that he's written a book, you know, these things that like the algorithm knows that I'm going to be interested in and attracted to, and that he's like right on the edge kind of. And I'm just like, man, this algorithm is something else. It's just really, really interesting.
This one I think is going to be quite interesting, seeing as essentially you do dream up and then execute tech products. So this could just be one that you currently have in the works, or one that you've always wanted to do but haven't managed to solve. If you could build a tech product that solved any problem in the world, what would it be and why?
Oh gosh, I think it would be funding community groups, because it's, you know, there's this huge resource imbalance, as I mentioned at the top of the show, between the hundreds of billions of dollars that goes into getting us clicking on advertising, buying more products online, towards solving the problems of community and democracy. And so one of the challenges, like really predating the internet, is how do you get people who are active in their community? How do you get that like local city group or state organizing group and have the resources to sustain themselves and grow? And so the right technology to do that would transform our society in the most positive ways.
Yeah, one of my old housemates is a data scientist, and he was just like, everyone in my industry has been hired by Google or Facebook, and there's an entire generation of talent that is being wasted on how do we get 2% more people to click on ads. Like, that's where everything in Silicon Valley's gone for the last 10 years. Like, it's just such a waste of talent.
Perfect segue into our last question. One of the threads that we always talk about in tech for good is balancing profit and purpose, and not necessarily that they're diametrically opposed, but I think, Daniel, I've seen you, you know, raise incredible sums of money from, you know, really, really powerful rich people for the benefit of supporting democracy and you know, making sure that it stays alive and healthy. I think you could have punched your ticket way earlier in your career and just gone off to one of these big companies. You used to have a speech recognition firm. So, you know, how have you done that well? How have you balanced profit and purpose? How have you sort of navigated those polarities in your own life?
Yeah, I think it's important for all of us to realize that we all have a unique role to play. And so part of that is skills, and part of that is motivation. And I think that for any of us to just settle for second best is to say, well, you know, I'm not that important, right? But if you believe in your importance, and it doesn't mean you have to be special in some way or different than other people, but if you care about the world and you want to improve it, then you will make a difference. I mean, one of the things that's been so evident to me over the many decades I've been trying to improve the country is like little things matter. Like little things matter. I mean, you know, so I talked earlier about, you know, Trump won by less than 100,000 votes, and so did Biden. But those are just the largest example. But just over and over, you know, it just takes one extra person or one extra person bringing in a friend, and then, you know, your city, you can get something passed in your city. You can push things in the right direction to the state. You can put out information that gets bounced around. I mean, the important thing is not to, there's a giant corporate media communication that comes over all forms of media that like you don't really matter and there's nothing you can do, but that is patently false. And you look at like the progress we've made in the US and the world, and like it all comes from individual people taking action.
Well, I think that's a good note to end it on. This has been an awesome conversation. I think you've shared with our audience like so many just important things that are happening. Like I know we tended to focus a little bit on some of the challenging things that are happening in the space, but I think you've given a lot of good examples of tech that's being deployed to kind of support democracy and equality, different, you know, community-led initiatives that folks are jumping into to do the same. And so we're grateful for your time. This has been an awesome conversation. So thank you.
Thank you, Paul. Thank you, Will.
Such a pleasure, yeah.
Daniel, where can folks find you on the interwebs and get in touch with you and MapLight?
Check us out at maplight.org. That's MAPLIGHT.org and unrigbook.com.
Amazing. We'll put those links in the episode description. And thank you again, Dan Newman, president and co-founder of MapLight. Thanks for your time today.
Thank you.